This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Earlier this week, the Vermont legislature took a few moments at the start of the day's work to mark a dark period in world history. 100 years ago this month, a slaughter began that wiped out 1.5 million Armenians living in the Ottoman Empire. Starting in 1915, Ottoman Turks murdered, starved, raped, and displaced three-quarters of the Armenian population. The United States has never officially recognized this as genocide, but many other countries have, and Vermont legislators took the time this week to acknowledge the solemn occasion with Armenian music and a joint resolution doing just that. Two Vermont writers of Armenian descent were present at the ceremony and gave a presentation afterwards. Dana Walrath and Chris Bojalian have both drawn on this history in their novels. Bojalian's book, The Sandcastle Girls, explores the experiences of refugees and victims of the Armenian genocide. Dana Walrath's novel in verse about children escaping the genocide is called Like Water on Stone. They both join us today to illuminate this history and to share their own personal family stories. Dana and Chris, welcome to Vermont Edition. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Jane. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, this is a history that is not very well known to many Americans. It certainly wasn't something I learned a lot about when I was in high school or college. So I'd like to take a little bit of time at the beginning here to talk about the history so that people know what we're discussing and why this is so important to you, both for your family roots and as something that you found as a source of inspiration for your writing. So let's talk a little bit about what led up to the beginning of this slaughter in 1915 and what was going on politically and culturally in the Ottoman Empire that could have led to a genocide. Dana, what was it like in the early 1900s in that part of the world?
Well, the Ottoman Empire had been in place for centuries, and starting at the end of the 19th century, it was really losing its power. There had already been a series of very bloody killings in 1895, the Hamidian massacres, and there were lots of things going on in the Balkans because the Ottoman Empire was shrinking everywhere on all of its peripheries. And very often, as places lose power, they're looking for someone to blame. And so pogroms came about. There was it had been a multicultural society, even though it wasn't completely fairly organized. There were lots of different religions coexisting together. But at the end of the 19th century, leading into the beginning of the 20th century, lots of killing was already starting to happen.
A couple hundred thousand Armenians were killed in the 1890s, I think.
250,000 Armenians were massacred in what were called the Hamidian massacres under Sultan Abdulhamid II. The parallels between the Armenian genocide and the Holocaust are incredible and horrific. They're the same kind of race laws in the Ottoman Empire against the Armenians that the Nazis would start inflicting upon the Jewish citizens of Germany in 1933. And in the same way that Hitler was looking for Lebensraum, or land, for Germans, the Ottoman Empire was looking for land east of Ankara in historic Armenia for all of the displaced citizens who were pouring into the Ottoman Empire from failed Balkan wars in Bulgaria and Romania.
And there was, as you said, Chris, a religious element here as well. Armenians are generally Christian. The Turks were generally Muslim. And so there was a religious element to this as well. So this was all sort of the backdrop to the start of World War One. And then in April, late April of 1915, that is generally recognized as the start of the Armenian genocide.
April 24th.
What happened on April 24th, Chris?
On the night of April 24th, the Armenian religious, intellectual, and business leaders of Constantinople, what is today Istanbul, were rounded up, and almost all of them would be summarily executed. That's where we view April 24th as the start of the genocide. By the end of the genocide, 1.5 million Armenians, 300,000 Assyrians, countless Greeks, would have been systematically annihilated by their government, or three out of every four. There are about 10 million Armenians alive today, and almost all of us are descendants of that final 500,000.
Dana, this is difficult history, but can you talk a little bit about what was done to Armenians? Men were often killed or sent to work on the railroad, where they often died. Women and children were not treated well. Many of them, as we know, died as well, but they were subjected to real brutality before that.
Yeah, once the men were systematically removed from all of the villages, I mean, there was an idea they were going to work on special labor battalions, but very often they were just brought out away from the village and summarily shot, or very often it was also brutal with knives and dismemberment and so forth, rather than just plain old shooting killings. Then for the women and children, they were all told that they would have to leave their homes, and they were marched away from their homes towards Aleppo and then eventually into the Syrian desert. And along the way, they were pillaged, they were raped, they were again dismembered. I mean, it's the kind of shocking stuff that is really hard to imagine. And because it happened in the early 20th century instead of the middle of the 20th century, we don't have films and photographs the same way that we do for more recent events. We didn't have journalists right there who could then text and tell us and take a picture and send, and so we could know what was happening. But it was so brutal.
And in fact, as we see in Chris Wargelian's novel, when there were people who were trying to get the message out of places like Aleppo, they were often mail was restricted, information was restricted, letters that were sent would be redacted or not sent. So there was a difficulty to get that information out to the rest of the world. What did people in other countries know at the time about what was happening?
At the time, the news did get out. I mean, one of the most biggest disseminators of it was Henry Morgenthau, who was the U.S. ambassador to the Ottoman Empire at that point. And his various people, other diplomats that were working further in the East, were funneling information to him. So now we have those primary source documents where you can read these horrendous descriptions of kind of walking into valleys and just seeing heaps and heaps of dead bodies, or rivers that have become completely red and clogged with blood and bodies. And so that he funneled back to the government, and it was all over the New York Times. I mean, thousands.
The New York Times ran at least 154 articles off the front page about the Armenian genocide as it was occurring. There were best-selling books by 1916 and 1917, including Aurora Mardiganian's memoir, Ravished Armenia, that was not merely a best-selling book. It would become an eight-reel silent film Hollywood blockbuster, of which one reel exists today. You can see it at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, the Genocide Museum in Yerevan, and yes, on YouTube. And what's on that YouTube clip? It is Hollywood's recreation of the moment from the memoir when Aurora watched women on the caravan stripped naked, nailed to wooden crosses, and crucified under the searing Syrian sun.
You know, it's worth mentioning, as people no doubt who are listening know, this is difficult history to talk about. And I understand that for many listeners, this feels shocking and difficult and hard to think about and hard to talk about, and perhaps not something that you're used to thinking about during your meal hour. But this is what happened.
And here's a flip side to this, which I think is really important as Americans. In the waning stages of the Armenian Genocide and after the First World War, the Armenian Genocide would prove to be the United States' first great humanitarian reach across the oceans effort. Near East relief was an American effort to save the Armenian children. Americans of a certain generation always say, you know, eat your peas, think of the starving Armenians. And they know that expression because they or their parents grew up aware of Near East relief. Imagine the United States saved 130,000 Armenian children in the 1920s.
People were saving, you know, sending pennies, sending food, sending clothes. It was the first time that American citizens unified, united, and tried to help people in another part of the world.
We're talking today about the Armenian Genocide. In The Sandcastle Girls, one of Chris Wargelian's characters describes the Armenian Genocide as the slaughter you know next to nothing about. If that's the case for you and you want to know more, or if you have a question about what happened in the Ottoman Empire 100 years ago, you can give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a thought or a question on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. If you have Armenian or Turkish ancestry and you'd like to share your own family story, you can do that as well. Again, our number, 1-800-639-2211. How did the killing stop?
Well, essentially, the war ended. That's the first. The genocide didn't end in 1918 when the war ended. There was sort of a brief respite. And it's important to note that in this brief respite, the first post-war Turkish government convicted the three architects of the genocide of what they called crimes against humanity and sentenced them to death. Talat, Jamal, and Enver Pasha were sentenced to death in absentia in July 1919 by the Turkish government. In the next 3 or 4 years, however, leading up to the second post-war Turkish government, the Ataturk government, the killings resumed. Many of the Armenians tried to return to the Anatolian plains, only to realize that they were every bit as unwelcome and in dire danger situations as they'd been a few years before, and would leave. And by 1924, there were virtually no human beings who described themselves as Armenian outside of what is today Istanbul. There are about 61,000 Armenians today living in Turkey, and they're all in Istanbul.
Given what Chris said a moment ago about how much Americans knew at the time about what was happening and the large-scale humanitarian relief effort, what about now, Dana? Why isn't this something that seems to be better known or more talked about in American history and in American culture?
Well, I think there's Turkey's strategic importance is the big reason, and its role in my childhood was that it was a place for NATO bases. So Cold War politics meant that the United States needed Turkey as an ally, and it brushed right up against Russia. And then, so I remember vividly being asked by my fabulous history teacher in 10th grade, you know, what am I supposed to know about the Armenians? And I'm thinking, I can't believe it. Even an educated person doesn't. But Cold War politics kept it out of our history books. End of the Cold War, we've shifted over to the dynamic that we have going on in the Middle East, and Turkey has been the moderate Muslim country in that part of the world. So the same thing is going on. So it's politics. Everybody bows and curtsies to them, and that isn't right. Justice is separate from politics.
But, you know, in contrast, when we think about the Holocaust in World War II, the reaction and the understanding that Americans have to that is very different. And the reaction in Germany is very different. On this note, we got a comment from Winston, who writes in to say, our national politicians ignore the elephant in the room by avoiding this example of mass genocide due to their unwillingness to alienate Turkey due to its strategic importance to NATO. Since the genocide occurred 100 years ago, it would be nice if present-day Turkey would fess up to the genocide that their forefathers undertook, just as present-day Germany has gone to great lengths to admit the atrocities committed by their Nazi relatives 75 years or so ago. As the old adage goes, confession is good for the soul. No reasonable person is going to consider present-day Turkish citizens accountable or complicit in the atrocity. As a matter of fact, Winston says, failing to label it as such as really an act of denial and cover-up. It would be an act of honesty and bravery for Turkish citizens to get this out on the table and to teach their children the truth.
Go, Winston.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah, I was once at the University of Texas Hillel. I was in the audience. I was listening to Gerda Weissman Klein speak. I'm a real fan of Gerda. She was the inspiration for my character, Cecile Fournier in Skeletons of the Feast, Holocaust survivor, survived death camps, marches in January and April 1945. And someone said to Gerda, what do you say to people who deny the Holocaust? And she shrugged and said, I really don't have to say much. I say, ask Germany. Germany doesn't deny it. And that's a pivotal difference between North American perceptions and comprehension of the Holocaust versus the Armenian Genocide. Turkey does deny it. And as Dana so eloquently explained, Turkey's strategic importance often trumps our moral compass in Washington.
Chris, can you talk a little bit more about when you say Turkey denies it? The Turkish government absolutely denies this as a genocide and says the slaughter was a part of war. It was a requirement in war. What about people in Turkey? Do regular Turkish citizens have any difference of opinion with the government on this?
Some do. I've lectured about the Armenian Genocide in Istanbul, and I've had audiences which have a lot of Turkish citizens and Turkish scholars and Turkish students. The reality, though, is that the way the First World War is still taught is mandated centrally out of Ankara. And a terrific Turkish-American scholar named Taner Akçem earlier this winter did a riveting and wrenching examination of what are the history textbooks that are required, not just in all Turkish schools, but even in, you know, in the Armenian schools in Istanbul. And essentially, the Armenians are painted as traitorous and satanic and you know, corrupt. And I have met Turkish citizens who want their government to acknowledge the genocide in the same way that American citizens wanted us to have a better civil rights record of the 1960s. I've met Turkish citizens who won't discuss it. I've met Turkish citizens who honestly, with a straight face, will say, oh, the Armenians, they all moved in 1908. As Dana's book, Like Water on Stone, you know, since so much is beautifully set in the Anatolian Plains, you know, all of those churches, there's so many of those remains are still there. And so how, if you are living east of Ankara, do you explain the remnants of this civilization that's just gone? How do you explain it? And it's just fascinating, the machinations that you go through.
And to add to that, it's not just that it's hidden, but anybody who tries to say anything about it can go to jail for insulting Turkishness. And Taner Akşam went into exile because of the work, the important work that he's done to show exactly what went on. And I mean, when children are learning in school, as Chris was saying, they're just learning a very distorted version of history. And then there's a difference in terms of resources and money. So you can find websites that are all about how this is an Armenian made-up story, which it isn't. It's something that's absolutely documented, that scholars have agreed about. And now it's time for politicians to do the right thing.
We're talking today about the Armenian genocide and listeners weighing in as well with their thoughts, their questions. Let's go to Anne, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Anne. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm the daughter of Armenian survivors. My father came here because they knew in the family, they were well-to-do. They knew there were rumblings, and they wanted to get out. The grandmother said, no, I want to die in my own home. She died. My uncles died. My aunts died. Everybody, my mother and father were the sole survivors in their respective families. But the thing I grew up listening to in my Armenian household were the incredible political dissension among my friends of the family, and we called them uncle and cousin. And, you know, it was elders were called aunt and uncle, and everybody else was cousin. But the dissension, the political, the Hunchag and the Dashnag and the Ramgabar and the Garmir, they were battling each other tooth and nail over the politics of a country that did not exist. Unlike the Jews, who mended their political fences, got a homeland back, and then went on to do their political discussions out loud. And why can't the Armenians learn something from the other nationalities?
In what sense, Anne? In the discussions, well, or in the idea of a homeland?
Well, the idea of the homeland, there was an Armenia, Republic of Armenia, very briefly in the 20s. And I think, again, Armenians are very passionate about their politics. They're very hot-blooded about their politics. And, you know, so we've sort of watched from the distance, nothing got resolved.
Let me draw this over to Dana, who's got some thoughts on this. I know she's just waiting to be able to help respond to you.
Well, I'm thinking about it as an anthropologist and thinking about what it's like to have your history denied, what it's like to have everything about you suppressed and not be legitimized. And it's not a moment that you can mobilize and build a new country. And the reason that the Armenian Republic failed was not because of infighting among the Armenians, and it's true. My grandparents, it was a Dashnag Ramgabar marriage, and you know that's complex. But I think that's just spirited conversation. It doesn't, in terms of how the consequences play out in the world at large, that has to do with what you internalize. And Armenians really have never had the legitimacy that the Jewish nation received when the whole world shifted because everyone said, "Wow, we cannot let that happen ever again." And really, to bring and circle that back around, there's the very famous quote from Hitler when he's talking to the Weimar and getting them all excited about, look, let's do this. We can systematically get rid of these people. And he said, after all, who remembers the Armenians? So I tend to give Armenians a coupon for any of those things. And then what I'm just so gratified to see is that right now, here we are at the 100th anniversary, and I've watched Armenians finally, we're at a place, we do have a country now. We have a little tiny landlocked country, but filled with vibrant and creative people. And everyone's putting their differences aside, and we're celebrating and ourselves as a people who have survived. So I think we're there now.
We're marking the 100th anniversary of the start of the Armenian Genocide today. Our guest Chris Bojalian writes about this as the slaughter you know next to nothing about in his recent novel, The Sandcastle Girls. And Dana Walrath also explores this history in her novel, Like Water on Stone. In just a moment, we're going to find out why these stories were so personal for these Vermont writers to tell. And you can ask them a question about the timeline they've just been laying out by writing to vermontedition@vpr.net. Or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we are marking the 100th anniversary of the start of the Armenian Genocide, when 1.5 million Armenians in the Ottoman Empire were killed by the Turks. We've been learning a little bit about that history from novelists Chris Bojalian and Dana Walrath, both Vermonters who've written about this period in time in recent books. They also both have family ties to Armenia, and we're going to explore some of their personal connections coming right up. If you have a question for Chris or Dana about how they've explored difficult historical and personal themes in their novels, or if you'd like to share your own family story, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Dave, who's calling in from Rutland. Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
Hi. I have an uncle, or he's passed away now, who, when he was a young boy, watched his parents. His father was a mayor of a town in Turkey. He watched his parents get murdered by the Turks. And then he apparently roamed with a group of children. They made their way to the coast, where they were picked up and brought to this country by a Quaker service organization, and that's how he got into our family, Quakers from Philadelphia, and married my aunt. And he was always very, he would not talk about it, not even to my cousin, his daughter. She has very few details of, he just wouldn't say anything. He's traumatized. And I just wonder if there's any way to get information to fill out the story a little bit more.
Dave, thank you for sharing your thoughts and your question. Chris and Dana, this is something both of you know about, stories that are half-told or covered and mysterious in your families that you're trying to find out more about. Chris, it's something that you write a lot about in The Sandcastle Girls.
Indeed. My grandparents were both survivors of the Armenian Genocide, and like so many survivors, they brought most of their stories to their grave. We know bits and pieces. We know that my grandmother, Haygui Sharinyan, her father provided cavalry horses to the Ottoman army and had for years. In 1915, rather than acquire the horses legally, they simply shot him to death, confiscated the herd, confiscated the horse farm, and for good measure confiscated the Sharinyan home. My grandfather had three brothers in 1915 who were all alive in Cairo. Somehow, between 1915 and the mid-1920s, when my grandparents wed in Paris, all three brothers were lost to the mists of history. We know nothing to explain their death or disappearance. Now, in my experience, I have met Armenians who have left behind copious notes and stories that are wrenching and horrific. And then I've met Armenians who are like my grandparents, who wanted to share almost nothing. There's a new book that was just published by Armin Marsubian called Fragments of a Lost Homeland, Remembering a Lost Armenia. And this is a really interesting book to me because his grandfather and great aunt both kept incredible diaries. And his grandfather was a photographer and was spared because the Ottoman governor wanted him to photograph that particular area. So he has both photographs that are wrenching and really interesting and these two diaries to pull upon.
So somebody like Dave can find stories of other families, can read novels like the ones that we're talking about today. And then, Dana, where else can he go to do research?
Well, one amazing resource is the Hushamadyan website. This is a project to reconstruct life in the Ottoman Empire before the genocide. So in 1914 is what they say. And if you know just the village that your uncle was from, Dave, you can go to that site and see how they've gathered together information from all sorts of other people. If you don't know the village, the Ottomans were actually incredible record keepers, and the people at Hushamadyan might be able to help you figure out how you might be able to track down his name. I, for example, just recently learned that my great-grandfather was a deacon in Polis, Istanbul. I never knew that until I wrote this book, and then my aunt told me this detail. And so I plan on going and trying to do archival research in Turkey. There are ways to kind of tease those things out. But in the meantime, you can go today, right now, to Hushamadyan, Hushamadyan, I think. And there's a list of resources in the back of my book that can be useful for you.
So in terms of finding family members, I know that for Holocaust survivors, there are groups that will help you find other family members who may have been displaced and may be now spread around the world. Is there an organization like that for survivors of the Armenian Genocide to find one another, to find family members?
Well, until recently, there was the Armenian DNA Project.
And that was helping through DNA, clearly?
It was helping family members find each other around the world to discover that a person in Yerevan might find a distant relative in Toronto, who might find a distant relative in Los Angeles.
We got a note from Pete in Newport who says his Armenian grandmother was born in 1910 and orphaned in 1915. Pete says she never mentioned the genocide once, and he asks how much of Western ignorance is due to the silence of Armenians.
I think that is a fascinating question. There's a certain amount, unquestioned, of victimhood, and we don't want to be perceived as victims, especially since so many of us, you know, we're a diaspora nation, since so many of us are in the United States, this land of great opportunity and pluck and luck and Horatio Alger stories. Who wants to be saddled with victimhood? I think that's why my father, for example, reinvented himself so profoundly. He grew up in a beautiful house just outside of New York City. Everyone spoke Armenian. When he started kindergarten, he could not speak a word of English. Couldn't ask where the boys' room was. And so he reinvented himself, and he became as American as he possibly could. I was 14 years old before I discovered how fluently he still spoke Armenian. And along those lines, what Pete is getting at, not knowing about our histories, I find this incredible. I grew up knowing that my great-grandfather, Nazaret Bedros, was a tailor, or maybe dabbled as a writer. That's what I always presumed. This winter, I unearthed an old Armenian encyclopedia, and I saw a photograph of clearly Nazaret Bedros. I shared it with my friend Hatshig Muradian, because I don't read a word of English, alas.
And neither of Armenian. You do read a word of English, luckily.
I don't speak a word of Armenian, forgive me, alas. So I shared it with my friend Hatshig, and Hatshig translated it for me. It's a 5-page entry about my great-grandfather. He wasn't a tailor who may have dabbled as a writer. He was an immensely gifted poet who in the 1870s was, for lack of a better term, he was a rock star in the Anatolian plains. He was a troubadour. He would perform between Jerusalem and Istanbul. And in 1895, his poetry changed a lot. Instead of Whitman-like celebrations, it grew really dark. Why? Well, Dana was talking about the Hamidian massacres when we began. On November 18th, 1895, they came to Kayseri, where he lived. And he witnessed the slaughter and wrote a 70-quatrain epic chronicling the dismemberment, the decapitation, the pregnant women having their babies pulled from their wombs, and the madness that ensued. Now, my great-grandfather died in 1902. My grandfather was born at the very end of the 19th century. He was the last child, a late-in-life child. And clearly the family was scattered by the Hamidian massacres. And that is my only explanation for why so little of my great-grandfather's story came down to my generation. You know, I've always been so, so proud to be my father's son, to be my grandfather's grandson. But it's only now at midlife that I've discovered I'm not the first Bojalian to try to make sense of a genocide in art. I am but the second. Hmm. And so that makes me so proud to be Nazaret Bedros's great-grandson.
And how fascinating that for both of you, you're still learning about your own families even after you've done all of this extensive research. Yeah. Dana, what about for you? What's your family story?
My grandmother was about a 10-year-old girl during the genocide. And when I was about that age, I asked my mother, what was her childhood like? Because my grandmother died about 6 or 7 years before I was born. And my mother said, after her parents were killed, she and Uncle Benny and Aunt Alice hid during the day and ran at night from Palu to Aleppo. And I kind of just didn't know what to do with that information. I lived in New Jersey.
And that's really far. Palu to Aleppo is not going from Burlington to Colchester.
Right. It's more like going from Burlington to Boston.
On foot. Desert.
Yeah.
In dangerous times.
Well, you know, in very dangerous times. And it was something that just haunted me. And so I had to figure out what to do with that. And it took me 30, 40 years to try and put it into a novel. My grandfather, he was a grown man. He lived in Van, a beautiful lake that's in eastern Turkey. The water tastes like licorice. It's got an Armenian church on an island in the middle of it. It's an incredible place. He lost his wife and his sons. His sisters made it over across into the Russia, Soviet Armenia, what is now Armenia. And then he somehow made it to the United States. So he was very silent. I spoke with my aunt recently, and she said he refused to talk about what happened. He died when I was about 6. So, and I haven't been lucky enough to discover a treasure trove of letters or anything like that. Though just the other day, I did find something that when I was getting ready for the State House, I knew I had a family tree someplace. And I did find something that one uncle had written about what he had heard from his father about life in Palu. And that was buried in my mother's papers. And so I think this is an interesting time that people are coming out of the closet. I spoke down at Responsibility 2015 earlier last month in New York City.
That was an international genocide conference.
And I had a person come up to me afterwards and say, I've got this stack of letters. What do I do? And I sent her right to Hushamadian, and they're translating them right now.
Wow.
Yeah. So
we're talking today all hour about the Armenian genocide with two Vermont writers whose Armenian heritage spurred them to write about the extermination of their people 100 years ago. We're going to talk a little bit more about why they both chose to explore this history and their own family connections through fiction. And we're hearing from listeners as well who have stories to tell of their own. If you would like to join them, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also share stories and photos on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We're spending the hour learning about the Armenian genocide today on Vermont Edition, and we've been doing it with the help of two novelists who have personal ties to Armenia and who've written about that period in history in their recent books, Chris Bojalian and Dana Walrath. We're hearing from some of you as well with questions and with your own family ties to Armenia. You can join us, call 1-800-639-2211 if you'd like to share. That number again, 1-800-639-2211, or send an email to vermontedition@vpr.net. Annette is calling in from Danby. Hi, Annette. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to share a couple of Vermonter connections. My husband's grandfather, Wilfred Post, was a missionary doctor who ministered to the Armenians during the genocide. And although I don't have any stacks of papers, it came alive to me when I discovered some things that, like a Russian icon that was among this doctor's daughter's possessions that had been given to him by Armenians as gratitude. And also, Henry Morgenthau's granddaughter, who's now in her 90s, lives in Vermont. Hmm. So there are a couple of Vermont connections.
Annette, thanks for sharing that. I appreciate it. Let's go to Bob in Jericho. Hi, Bob. You're on.
Hi. I have a question concerning the establishment of the modern state of Armenia in the former Soviet Union. Were people displaced when the state was established? And if so, how did they avoid the mess that Israel and Palestine are in now?
Bob, thanks for your question. Dana, Chris, which one of you feels qualified to answer that?
The independent Republic of Armenia came of age, of course, about a quarter of a century ago when the Soviet Union collapsed. The Caucasus are complicated ethnically because of Stalin, not so much because of where the indigenous peoples lived, but because of the way Stalin consciously balkanized Azerbaijan, Armenia, Georgia, to try to dial down possible nationalism. As a result, in Armenia's first few years of independence, it was not simply coping with the after effects of a cataclysmic earthquake that shut down the nuclear power plant and left hundreds of thousands homeless in Gumri, the second largest city, but it had to fight for its territorial integrity against Azerbaijan. As a result, today, there is both Armenia and the independent nation of Nagorno-Karabakh. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dana, who knows a lot about NKR and has been there.
And have been in Armenia, where there were many people who had to flee Azerbaijan during that huge war. Karabakh is also an independent republic. It tried an independent state. It established itself at the same time that the Soviet Union was falling apart, and then the conflict appeared maybe within the next 4 or 5 years when there was a war between Armenia and Azerbaijan about what would be the outcome of that. But what we have to look at is that there's a history of not being able to have Armenians live safely within Azerbaijan. There's a whole part of Azerbaijan that's over to the west of Armenia called Nakhichevan that has all of the Armenians who were there had to leave in the 1950s. Everything was confiscated. All the churches were destroyed. You can see photographs that show this was an Armenian cemetery, and now it's a military base and things like that. Over in Karabakh, what you see now is this small, poor republic has not destroyed any of the Islamic buildings that were part of that were there and part of the Silk Route. And you can also see, though, that Azerbaijani roads were built through things, right straight through Armenian cemeteries.
And God bless Vermont. I've met a number of Vermont Armenians who came here after the pogroms in Baku, Azerbaijan, in the 1990s, when it was no longer safe for Armenians to live in Baku. And Vermont has embraced them and has taken them in.
Mm-hmm. You know, we've been talking a lot about the history here and about your own family stories, both of which really form the backdrop and the inspiration for the work that you've done in these novels. And we could talk for an hour each on each of these novels as well. And I won't, except to say that they're very compelling stories on their own. But why did you want to take your family stories, your family pain and hidden stories and strength and the history and treat it in fiction? What inspired that choice? Or, you know, why not write about your family stories as articles? What made you think I can get this story out to people to read in a fictionalized account?
I think fiction goes right to people's hearts. And when we have a situation where politicians are arguing over facts, let's just do a very American thing and do an end run around the facts and go right to people. And so that's what fiction can do. That's what novels can do. I also, when I was writing, I mean, I had only one sentence of my family history to go by, that my grandmother and a younger brother and sister had hid during the day and ran at night. I knew also that they carried a pot with them. But that's it. And what I wanted to do in fiction was write a story that could share the history, but could also show our strength and could also show a path towards peace. Because I think that one of the dangers is that people fall into a trap of saying, oh, all Turks are terrible and all Azerbaijanis are terrible. And instead of saying the Turkish government is denying the genocide. There was a war and there are political things happening with governments. And this leaves the chains of communications open so that people can go from heart to heart and do what's right. And that's why I went to fiction.
And in your novel, Dana, it's a novel in verse, and mm-hmm. it's written from the point of view of these three young children who are doing this great journey, and from the point of view of an eagle. There's sort of some magic realism in there as well, an eagle who helps protect these children and can narrate a little bit yeah. of what's going on. Why that choice?
The choice was because I think imagination is what gets us through tragedy. And the eagle, I think, is an embodiment of those young children's strength and their imaginations and what they used. And then I also needed someone who could see everything that was happening, and so an eagle made that possible. But I think that when people are faced with such horrific situations, what gets them through is their imaginations, and that's why magical realism seemed very appropriate.
Chris, in reading your novel, The Sandcastle Girls, I have to say it was brutal to read it. I mean, you do not flinch from the terrors that were inflicted on these people. It was particularly difficult for me to read scenes about children being ripped from their mothers being raped and killed in front of their children starving to death. Why? I mean, you clearly made a choice here in saying this happened, this was brutality, and you have to see it in this novel. You don't let your readers turn away. Why did you want people to have to go through that experience in reading this story?
Well, you know, first of all, I also view the book as a love story. I view it as a big, sweeping, epic love story. My models for this book weren't novels about evisceration. They were novels like The English Patient and Atonement. And I also wanted to write this book not for Dana's family or my family. You know, Armenians know the stories. Our ancestors survived the stories. I was writing this book for people who couldn't find Aleppo on a map in Jacksonville and Indianapolis. And so I decided a love story in the midst of this cataclysm involving, yes, an American girl, a Mount Holyoke Spitfire named Elizabeth Endicott, who journeys there with the Boston-based Friends of Armenia. And it's there that she meets Ahriman Petrosian, a young engineer, widower, looking desperately for remnants of his beloved family in Aleppo. Yeah, there are parts of the book that are heavy sledding, but reality is heavy sledding, and certainly the Armenian genocide was horrific in the systematic brutality that occurred.
Dana, before we go today, before we leave this hour, you both have spent a lot of time in the part of the world that we've been discussing today, and you're about to head back there this weekend, right?
This weekend, yeah. The students at the TUMO Center for Creative Technology, under the direction of one of my cousins from Palu originally, they're making an animation of Like Water on Stone, and it's premiering on April 21st, so I'm going over there for that.
What's it like to be there around April 24th?
Oh, it's magnificent. Have you been there on the 24th ever, Chris?
No, I've never been there on April 24th.
It's unbelievable. When I was there 2012, 2013 as a Fulbright scholar, and I finished doing the revisions of Like Water on Stone while I was there. And whenever I needed to do research at the Genocide Museum, I would... I had an instinct to walk there. And when April 24th rolled around, I realized it's because every citizen of the city of Yerevan and from all of the outlying areas comes to Yerevan and makes this pilgrimage up the avenues, across a bridge, through a park to the genocide memorial in order to honor all of those steps that were taken when our ancestors were marched out into the desert. And it's unbelievable. Everybody carries flowers. People walk in groups, family groups, village groups, and the flowers are all laid around a flame. And I'm so honored, lucky to be able to be there this year on April 24th, because not only will there be everybody from Armenia, but I think quite a few people from all over the world are planning on being there as well.
And Chris, do you know of anything happening in Vermont or in our region?
Well, certainly in Boston, certainly in Providence. I will be speaking in Chicago City Hall on April 24th, the Connecticut State House on the 25th. I'll be in St. Louis just before then. I was just so proud, though, of what Vermont legislatures did. The Vermont legislature did yesterday. That was huge and courageous. And big props to Joan Lennis, Philip Baruth, Adam Gresham, Diane Snelling for championing Armenian Genocide recognition.
Yes, this was something that just happened the other day in the Vermont legislature, which acknowledged the Armenian Genocide and led the day, started out the day with Armenian music.
And I have to say, yes, and playing the oud was Dana's husband in the State House, and it got a standing ovation. It was awesome.
It was.
Chris Bojalian's novel exploring the experiences of refugees, witnesses, and victims of the Armenian Genocide is called The Sandcastle Girls. Anthropologist and writer Dana Walrath's novel in verse about children escaping the genocide is like water on stone. Thank you both for sharing your stories, your work, and the history today. I appreciate it.
Janota Gollum, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Listeners, you can, of course, continue the conversation. Go to the Facebook page for Vermont Edition. Share your family's stories. Share photos if you have them. We'd love to see them. That's it for today. Tomorrow, we mark another historical moment. 150 years ago this month, some important battles involving Vermont troops led to the end of the Civil War in the middle of the month. We'll discuss those and the impact in Vermont of President Lincoln's death with historian Howard Coffin. You can send your Civil War questions or comments to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.